Heichel Menachem presents A Tale of Two Souls, an ongoing lecture series on the Tanya by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Jacobson. This is tape number 66 in the series entitled, How Do I Become Inspired? Summary of chapters 18 through 25 of the Tanya. This class was recorded live at Heichel Menachem, Brooklyn, New York, on the 4th of Nisan, 5759.
We are up to the 25th chapter of the Tanya. Now, in this chapter, Perek Chaf Hei, the Alter Rebbe sums up the entire discussion. He wraps up the theme that he began in chapter 18, making these eight chapters, 18 through 25, one single unit. In the beginning of chapter 18, the Alter Rebbe revisits the motto upon which the entire book is based, as he wrote in the title page of the Tanya, that the book is based on the verse in the Torah portion of Nitzavim, Ki karei ve'lecha adavar miyoid, b'ficho v'vavcha la'asayse. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he's saying his goodbye to his beloved people several days before he passes on to the next world, tells the Jewish people that this thing, this matter, is close, is very close and very accessible to you in your mouth and in your heart to do it. And here one asks the question, how can the Torah make such a claim? That a life permeated fully, a life ordered utterly by the ideals of Torah, is highly accessible, is very close to you. It's a feasible goal within the reach of every single Jew. There are so many temptations, struggles, cravings, impulses that make it so difficult. It's a lofty goal, it's a holy goal, but apparently one divorced from reality and real life to say that it is indeed within reach of every Jew to live a life utterly according to the ideals of Torah, and that's very close and accessible, seems not so realistic. And furthermore, Moshe Rabbeinu claims that it's highly accessible to you, not just in your mouth, to do it, to perform it, but also bilvavcha, which the Alter Rebbe takes to mean literally, it's highly accessible to you in your heart. That to experience an emotionally charged relationship with Hashem is a highly accessible goal. Your heart is always fertile soil to become consumed by a passionate love towards Hashem. Moshe Rabbeinu is telling you that your heart, levavcha, is always a ready target susceptible to become inflamed, roused by a yearning, a pining to embrace Hashem, Torah, Yiddishkeit, to become in love emotionally with godliness and spirituality is an attainable goal for every Jewish heart. And here one asks the question, whose heart are you talking about? My heart. Not the last time I visited it. My heart gets turned on to lots of stuff. But not to Hashem and to His truth. Not to spirituality and godliness. The Torah seems to be describing an emotional availability that's non-existent. To say that it's karev ma'ayd b'levavcha. Let's get real. It's fascinating that Alter Rebbe here, and Alter Rebbe in Tanya, asks a question when he writes the Tanya 200 years ago, a question that you can ask this morning, this very morning, which in turn may cause many and has caused many to ask the next logical question. The fact is that I am uninspired, a Jew says. I'm unmotivated, I'm uninterested. At least very often I'm apathetic, cold, detached. I crave a lot of things. My heart is fertile soil to lots of emotions. I crave money and success and personal pleasure and power. I crave inflated savings accounts, food, sleep, a host of other physical enjoyable endeavors and pleasures which have very little to do with spirituality. They might even be contrary to Torah and so forth. I don't care. I'm not emotionally attached to spirituality and godliness. So why should I embrace Yiddishkeit? Why should I not follow my heart's cravings? Am I to betray my emotions, my instincts, my cravings for the sake of a foreign celestial document? For the sake of a superimposed heavenly constitution? And the answer has to be as good as the question. You know, when you ask a good question, you better have a good answer. And this is the question Alter Rebbe raised. Zogt Alter Rebbe in the beginning of chapter 18, that yes, indeed it is highly accessible. And furthermore, it's not just highly accessible to you, you can obtain it, you can obtain a b'levavcha, you can obtain an emotional relationship. But it's actually happening, it's actually part of your life at this very moment. Right at this very moment, Alter Rebbe says in the beginning of 18, you are inspired, you are invigorated, you are in love with Hashem. Your heart is on fire towards spirituality and holiness. You do care. You're crazy about Yiddishkeit. You just have to tune in to what's going on in the insides of your soul. You need to take an x-ray of your soul, and you'll see this to be the case. Now, it's important to understand, 200 years later, during which the world has been saturated with chassidus, with Jewish mysticism and spirituality, it seems simple to say. But then when the Alter Rebbe revealed, established, developed this idea and made it a cornerstone in his outlook and his perspective on life, it hit so many Jewish hearts like a bomb. Because although the Alter Rebbe, as well as his predecessors, the Magid, the Baal Shem Tov, his teachers, showed this to be a central theme in Yiddishkeit, it was not blatantly obvious, not at all obvious. Zogt Alter Rebbe, that if you probe the layers of man's consciousness, if you enter into the depths of his psyche, a depth that he himself may be unaware of, and you can do this at any time of the day or at any time of the night, go into the deep chambers of a soul, you'll discover a soul that's burning with a love towards Hashem, towards truth, towards spirituality. How do we say in Yedid Nefesh? Yedid Nefesh is a beautiful poem that's recited in many Jewish communities Friday afternoon before the mincha, before we greet the Shabbos, before the afternoon services of Friday afternoon. Many Jewish communities, it's recited during Suda Shlishes, during the third meal of Shabbos. Shabbos at twilight. And it was composed through a Jew, a great Kabbalist, halachist, whose name was Rebbe Lazar Askiri. He lived in Tzvas, in the Holy Land, in the 16th century. And his most famous book is known as Sefer Chiredim, which the Alter Rebbe actually quotes in chapter 32 of the Tanya. And he composed this extraordinary liturgy, which begins with the words Yidid Nefesh of Harachaman. There are many famous tunes to the words. And there he expresses himself so movingly. He says, he quotes the Jew as saying, Nafshi choylas ahavasecha, ana keilna refanala baharis lanoyam zivecha, as tischazek v'sisrape v'hoysal asimchas oylam. My soul, the Jew is crying, is lovesick for you. Please, God, heal her by showing her the sweetness of your countenance. Then she will become strong and healed and experience joy for eternity. How brilliant, how deep, how accurate a definition for the soul. Perhaps the best definition that was ever given for the soul. Your soul, my soul, our soul doesn't need ego, doesn't need politics, is uninterested in lies and gossip and manipulation and deceit and corruption. The soul needs transcendence. The soul needs love. The soul yearns for spirituality, for truth, for godliness, for the real thing. The soul pines to drown, to be submerged in the endless, infinite, all-pervading reality of Hashem. At every moment of the day, nafshi chaylas avasecha, get to know your soul and you'll see a psyche that's sick, that's lovesick for you. It's just that man has two eyes. Man has two eyes, not one eye. A tale of two souls. The external eye and the real eye. What the Alter Rebbe defines in the Tanya as the egotistical consciousness versus the idealistic soul. The Nefesh HaBahamas and the Nefesh HaLikis. The beastly ego and the divine flame. As he put it in chapter 19. And the external eye often conceals the real eye and causes man to substitute the real eye with the external eye. To the extent that he begins perceiving his exclusive identity based on the persona of the external eye. This is on a most simple and a very basic level. Sugar is not healthy for me. For my body, sugar is unhealthy. But naturally, I crave it. I crave it very strongly. I love sugar. I love foods that have sugar within them. This morning, this Sunday morning, I craved to eat something with a lot of sugar. Did I crave it? Did I desire it? 100% I did. But it's obvious that this craving, which was coming, which was stemming from my psyche, from my disposition, was covering up, was obscuring a deeper eye, which is uninterested in having sugar because it's harmful to my life, harmful to my health, and so on and so forth. But the external eye was really craving it. And when I craved it, I felt that I totally crave it. There's no part in me that doesn't crave it. But really, do I really crave it? It destroys my health. It destroys my body. The real eye doesn't crave it. But the external eye is called klipa. In Tanya, in Kabbalah, in Chassidus, it's called klipa, a shell, a cover-up. Because its function is that it covers the true eye. And if I take the external eye seriously and I would fulfill my craving and go devour Danish after Danish and so forth, I will sacrifice my true eye for my external eye. And that's what klipa is. It isolates me from my true eye. It isolates my behavior, my patterns, my conduct from my true eye. But of course, what's the problem? The problem is that the klipa doesn't acknowledge it's a klipa, doesn't acknowledge it's a shell. If yes, it wouldn't be a klipa. If the shell would tell you, hey, this is the shell talking to you, it wouldn't be a shell. The problem is that klipa defines herself as your exclusive identity. But in essence, it's merely a husk. It's one big cover-up. It's one big lie. Theoretically, if somebody would tell you, if you were to know that you have 2 hours left to live, heaven forbid, but you know you have 2 hours left to live, what would you do during those 2 hours? How would you occupy the final 2 hours of your life on earth? Would you go to the office? Would you go onto the internet? Would you go read a newspaper? Will you go to the gym? Will you go to a restaurant? What will you do during those 2 hours? Let's think for a moment. What would we do? Think about it honestly and you'll discover. We'll discover that many of us, what we will do during those 2 hours, we don't do too often. Which means that which is the most important and the most essential to us, very often is not part of our daily eye. And at a moment of truth, I suddenly discover a new eye which has new priorities and new interests that override all the other interests which I'm usually occupied with. A few weeks ago, we celebrated Purim. Excuse me. It says in Zayar, in Tikkuni Zayar, that the name Yom HaKippurim, Yom Kippur, Yom HaKippurim is Yom HaKippurim. The significance of the holiest day in the Jewish calendar, Yom Kippur, is that it's like Purim. And what's the holiest moment of Yom Kippur? What's considered one of the most sacred, extraordinary moment of Yom Kippur? Kol Nidre. We open up the Yom Kippur evening. Yom Kippur begins, commences with the stirring prayer of Kol Nidre. A very special sanctity is felt in the ambiance of Shul as Jews from all walks of life, from all backgrounds and all affiliations come to Shul, if not all year, but once a year at least, Yom Kippur for Kol Nidre. What happens during Kol Nidre? If you open up a siddur, a machzer, during Kol Nidre we say Kol Nidre, and so forth, the Jew annuls all of the vows and promises and oaths that he might make during the coming year, from this Yom Kippur to the next Yom Kippur. And what's the significance of Kol Nidre from a halachic point of view? The halachists discuss this at length. The Russian tractate Yuma, the 8th chapter of Yuma, discusses, elaborates upon what Kol Nidre is. The Tur brings it in Hilchos Yom HaKippurim, the Rosh's son, the Tur. The Alter Rebbe in Hilchos Yom HaKippurim and his Shulchan Aruch discusses it at length. Basically, the present version of Kol Nidre, its primary source is Rabbeinu Tam, the grandson of Rashi, Rabbeinu Tam. And the point is, we nullify our promises for the upcoming year, so that during the year, they saw that Jews often make vows and promises and oaths, and not realizing the severity of it, they don't keep it, they don't fulfill it, and it's a real transgression. So on Yom Kippur, you nullify it. So even if you don't do it, you haven't violated this commandment of against violating a vow or a promise or an oath, because it was all annulled in Yom Kippur. Why do we do it on Yom Kippur? So the Rosh gives a few reasons, the Rosh and Yuma. One reason is because all Jews come to Shul on Yom Kippur. So you want to do it at that time when all Jews are there. Another reason is the Gemara in Adarim, Tav Chav Gimel Amid Beis, suggests to do it on Rosh Hashanah, to annul the vows for the upcoming year. And the Rosh says that in Tanakh, in Yecheskel, in Ezekiel, in chapter 40 of the Navi Yecheskel, Yom Kippur is called Rosh Hashanah. So when the Gemara suggests to do it on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur is just fine to do it. This is the basic halachic idea behind Kol Nidre. But the question is, whence the tremble, the awe, that consumes every single Jew during Kol Nidre? Kol Nidre is a time when you could sense a godly spirituality, a holiness, a celestial ambiance pervading every shul, pervading every Jewish heart. Ultimately, it's very technical. Read Kol Nidre. It's one of the most technical things we do during the whole year. You're basically talking about the possible promises and oaths and vows that you're going to accept upon yourself from this Yom Kippur to the next Yom Kippur. and you're saying that it should all be annulled, it should all be nullified, it should all be untied. Nidiran Allah Nidri, my promises are not promises. Vasaran Allah Asari, the prohibitions that I prohibit myself with should be annulled. Ushvu Asanal Ushla Shvuas, my oaths are not oaths. What's so moving about that? What's so sacred about that? It's important, it's significant, it's moral, it's ethical, but that's Kol Nidre. Jews, for centuries, Kol Nidre, they go crazy from. Kol Nidre is something special. The melody of Kol Nidre melts away every Jewish heart. And the spiritual explanation for this is based on what's discussed in Chassidus and based on what's discussed in these chapters of Tanya. Is as follows. If you were to come to a person, to a friend, and you'll ask him, tell me, do you know yourself? Are you familiar with yourself? Do you know your heart, your mind, your personality? The ordinary man, the ordinary adult, who has already been around the block once or twice or three times, what will be his response? Of course I know myself. And when you'll continue to ask him, can you swear on that? Can you swear on that you know yourself? And when you describe who you are, can you swear on that? And the man will say, of course, I can swear on that. Nobody knows me better than I know myself. Ultimately, even the closest people, we know ourselves in a way that nobody knows. We know ourselves totally. We know ourselves with all our mishigasin, with all our gloominess, with all our lovely things, and with all our darkest secrets and so forth. I mean, there's nobody who knows ourselves like we know, because we experience everything, right? We know every thought, we know every instinct, we know every impulse, we know every piece of envy, politics, hatred, animosity, idealism. I mean, we know everything about ourselves. So of course I can swear. I can swear on that. I know my ambitions, I know my cravings, I know what I need. I need honor, I need power, I need strength, I need money, I need comfort, I need a big home, I need nice clothes, I need nice, good food, whatever it is, every person according to their own cravings and ambitions and so forth. I need knowledge, I need wisdom, I need entertainment, I need emotional vulnerability, whatever it is. I could swear on that. I can swear that I know who I am. I can swear what I am, what I need, what I want. In fact, I do swear on it because that's how I live daily. And then Yom Kippur arrives. Yom Kippur approaches. A Jew comes to Shul on Yom Kippur. And suddenly, a new eye emerges. Suddenly the Jew sees that he doesn't know himself. On Yom Kippur, the Jew feels nafshi chaylas avasecha, that he wants to melt away in the all-pervading reality of Hashem. Which brings to mind a story that occurred on Rosh Hashanah. But the Rosh writes that Yom Kippur is also called Rosh Hashanah, so it's relevant to Yom Kippur as well. It was the summer of 1886 when the great Hasidic master, the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Shalom Ber Shneyusin, spent the summer in Yalta. And he used to daven during his entire stay in the klois, in the shtibel, in the shul of the Hasidim of Poland. And from time he would daven there daily, and from time to time he would give a dindava, a nice donation for the shul and for the shamish, for the assistant who took care, who ran the shul, who cleaned it and so forth. But nobody knew who the Rebbe was. The Rebbe came from Russia, from the city of Lubavitch, and the crowd in Yalta did not know who the Rebbe is. Came the night of Rosh Hashanah, Tafresh Mem Zayin, 1886. So after the entire crowd finished Meir of the first night of Rosh Hashanah, and went home, the Rebbe stayed in Shul alone in order to daven Ma'ariv according to his own pace, because there was the custom of the Rebbes of Chabad, of Lubavitch, that the first night of Rosh Hashanah they would daven Ma'ariv for at least a few hours, between 3 and 6 hours, during which they would weep profusely. So they would stay there, they would be there with the minyan, and then when the minyan would finish, they would stay in Shul and daven Ma'ariv alone. So the shamish of the shul, the assistant of the shul, commanded the non-Jewish janitor who took care of the cleanliness and so forth, that he should not extinguish the candles and he should not lock the door so that the Rebbe should be able to go out. And then the shamish left shul and he went home to eat the meal, the Rosh Hashanah feast. When the shamish completed the meal, he was ready to retire to bed. But he was a nice man, he was a decent Jew, a simple Jew. His heart started to bother him. He felt it so improper to leave a Jew, a Torah scholar, a Talmud Chacham, alone in shul. He didn't know who it was, but he knew that he was a Torah scholar, a Talmud Chacham. He felt it's not nice to leave him alone in shul. So the shamish decided to go back to the shul. He comes back to shul, and as he walks in, he sees that near the door, near the outside door, the non-Jewish janitor is standing and weeping. This was a sight that he never saw before. He says, "Why are you weeping?" So the non-Jewish janitor says, "How can I not cry? I'm observing here a human being who's melting away like wax in a flame. Usually I see you guys, you sing during davening, you dance during davening, it was a chassidish shtibel. But here is standing a Jew and he's just melting away in his davening. So when I see this, I remind myself about all my problems. My uncle died last year, my cow died this year, and my old mother is sick. So how can I not cry?" When the shamish went into shul, and he looked at the Rebbe and he heard how he was davening, so two oceans of tears flowed down from the shamish's eyes, instinctively, suddenly. This was told by the Rebbe's son, who later replaced him as the sixth Rebbe of Chabad, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was a young boy and spent that Rosh Hashanah with his father in Yalta. So when Yom Kippur arrives, a Yid comes to shul. When the sun sets over the horizon of Erev Yom Kippur, and the godliness of Yom Kippur enters the ambiance, the Jew suddenly feels a new identity. He craves to melt away in the all-pervading reality of Hashem like a flame in a huge bonfire. So the first thing the Jew says is, "Kol Nidrei. Nidrana la nidre vasarana la sare ushvua sana la shvuis. My oath is not an oath. The oath that I swore that I know who I am, and I lived my life based on that oath. It's not an oath. The Jew soars. He sets his soul free from all of the shackles of ego, of materialism that held it captive. The Jew returns to his true self. And this is the central, the critical theme of chapters 18, 19, 25, which we will soon learn in Tanya, that the Jew has to remember that beneath the pile of apathy, of coldness, of laziness, of spiritual dullness, there is a burning oven, a powerful, intense oven that's burning with an intense affection and love towards Hashem. As the Alter Rebbe put it in 18 and 19, if your Jewishness was challenged at this moment, if someone would demand from you to estrange yourself from your brothers and sisters, to deny the one God, you would sacrifice your life not to betray your God. So you're telling me that you really don't care, that you have no passion? Just because you're not experiencing that passion in a palpable way, just because you're experiencing temptations of an opposing nature as a result of the external eye, does that mean that you are to alienate yourself from your real self? Your real self is consumed by a fire towards Hashem. You don't want to live a life in which you will be disloyal to yourself, in which you will repress, abuse your own truth. Don't call your soul it. It's your inner truth. It's your gem. It's your sacred space of innocence. Don't allow your soul to be abused like that. It's unfair. Now, the problem is, obviously, that in the world, when we grow up, we don't hear about the internal eye, about the real eye. We're only familiar with the external life. You open up the radio, you read a newspaper, you only get to know your external eye. You don't know about your internal eye. And thus, you don't know that you have to nourish it. You certainly don't know how to nourish it. Torah and mitzvahs, on one level, are the tools to access the inner eye and to live with it. Each mitzvah is designated to serve as a window to the inner eye, as a doorway to the inner identity of the Jew. And this is what the Alter Rebbe will culminate in chapter 25, the point. That as a result of this understanding, we can now understand the claim of Moshe Rabbeinu as he says goodbye to the Jewish people, that it's Karev Elecha, Yiddishkeit is close to you. Even though, as we mentioned, the question is, in the beginning of the class, it seems so difficult, and it is difficult. Because when you're aware of this truth, you have the power at every moment of your life, in exciting times and boring times, during inspiring moments, during gloomy moments, during gloomy moments, at all day, at all times of your life. You possess the power to live a life consistent fully with the Torah. With this awareness of one's inner and true self, no temptation in the world can force him to estrange himself from himself. When you remember this, you can withstand every craving in the world because you know its futility, you know its source of power, and you know who you really are, you know where the craving is coming from. So you can withstand all temptations in the world. That's concerning issue one, issue A, your mouth, and to do it. But furthermore, with this awareness, we can also understand the belavavcha, the emotional availability. We understand that to develop a passion towards Hashem is highly accessible. You know why it's highly accessible? Because in fact, it's existing already. It need only to be revealed, to be exposed, to be tuned into. It's existing. You are in love. You just may be unaware of it, which is not an uncommon phenomenon in the human psyche, in all types of relationships. This experience, and the Alter Rebbe says, all day, all night, you're in love with Hashem. So when you ask the million-dollar question, what should I do when I'm uninspired? What should I do when I'm unmotivated, when I'm not excited? How can I become enthusiastic? The Alter Rebbe's answer, go look in the mirror. There's a story about one of the leading Hasidic masters of the early 19th century, the Holy Reb Meir of Primishlan. He was once riding in a coach, and at one of the scheduled stops, the leader of another Hasidic group entered the carriage, and there was a bitter dispute between these two masters at the time. And the newcomer, who was Reb Meir Primishlan's chief antagonist, he had various antagonists, and he was his chief antagonist. This man found, to his dismay, that the only vacant seat in the carriage, in the coach, was the seat directly opposite the seat of Reb Meir of Primishlan, that seat he was looking for. So the man sat down, he had no choice, but for hours on end, Reb Meir's fellow traveler kept his face averted. He refused even to glance at Reb Meir's direction. Finally, Reb Meir of Primishlan addresses him. He says, "My dear friend, let me tell you a story. In Inquisition Spain, there lived a man who was a minister in the king's cabinet. He held a very high position in the monarch. In the monarchy. And many years earlier, when the Jews of Spain were given the choice of converting to Christianity or leaving the country in 1492, this man's grandfather found it impossible to abandon his wealth, his prestige, He just couldn't do it. So what he did was, like many other Jews, he publicly assumed the Christian faith. But in secret, he and his family remained observant Jews. One day, this minister fell gravely ill, and it was soon obvious that he will pass on to the next world. He was at death's door. So the court bishop came to administer the minister during his last moments to help him with the confession and so on and so forth. The minister, you can understand, had really no desire to die in the bosom of the church. So when the bishop came near his bed, he averted his face. He turned his face to the wall. The bishop is chanting and praying and singing and everything, but the minister refuses to participate, even to acknowledge his presence, even to acknowledge the ceremony. Nothing, garnished. The bishop is going on and on, but to no avail. This minister has an averted face. His face is to the wall. He doesn't even look at him. Suddenly, the bishop realized what was going on. He understood what's going on. He puts his lips close to the dying man's ear. And he says, "You need not to avert your face from me. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad." To which his newly discovered brother, the minister, responds, "Baruch Shem Kvoid Malchusei La'olam Vad." My dear brother, concluded the holy Reb Meir of Primishlan, you need not avert your face from me. After all, regardless of how we might seem to each other, we both worship the same God. Our Shema Yisrael is identical. So the Alter Rebbe says that in the ultimate scheme of things, you need not to avert your face from yourself. You need not go look elsewhere to find redemption, to find spirituality. Look into yourself and you will find a soul who 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, screams and shouts, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. The year of 1903, Tofrish Samar Gimel, the Rebbe Rashab, who I mentioned earlier, the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, he spent that winter, most of the entire winter and part of spring, he spent in Vienna. And each day he would learn, he would daven and learn in a big kloiz, in a big shul that belonged to Polish Chassidim, to Chassidim from Poland. And he would usually sit for hours each day and learn Gemara, and he would also learn, particularly during the whole winter, Chayshim Mishpat, Shulchan Aruch, a tour in Shulchan Aruch of Chayshim Mishpat with the commentaries, the Beis Yosef and so forth. He used to learn together with his son, who later became the next Rebbe, as I mentioned, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson. And the Chassidim there did not recognize him, they didn't know who he was. The previous Rebbe related that during that winter of 1903, his father, the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, had many encounters with Sigmund Freud, which is another fascinating subject. Now, every day, the elder Chassidim of the Klois would come over to the Rebbe, and they would each day say the same thing: "Junger Mann, gib Tabak, young man, give us some tobacco to snuff, tobacco to smoke." And the Rebbe who always had tobacco would always give it to them. Now, he was a young man, relatively speaking. The Rebbe was then 42 years old. So each day, the elder Chassidim would say, "Junger Mann, gib Tabak." One day, after knowing him already for a few months, one of the elder Chassidim comes over to him and says, Junger Mann, was wird sein mit dir? Young man, what's going to be with you? Everything is by you in the mind. Midaf haben a bissel hearts. You need a little bit heart, a little bit emotions. He observed the Rebbe learning and studying and racking his brain and toiling his mind. He says, you need emotions, you need affection, you need an emotional inspiration, fervor, zealousness. So the Rebbe Rashab, the Rebbe is listening and he says, Nu, what do I do? How do I get that? How do I develop such emotions? So this man says, young man, we have here a very precious book, a very precious sefer. It's a sefer that sets the Jew's heart on fire. The sefer is called Likutei Amarim Tanya. Why don't you get the sefer and start learning it? And he takes out a Tanya and he shows him the Tanya. And the Rebbe, Fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, takes the Tanya, looks at it. He says, yeah, a good sefer. It's a good book, And from a certain perspective, this indeed is one of the central points of Tanya. That a heart filled with passion and love towards spirituality, towards godliness, does not have to be invented. It doesn't have to be created. It's already existing. Go look at your true self and you'll discover a heart on fire towards godliness. Remember the real you. Always remember that you. Remember the you that exists beneath the superficial coverings. The you that runs far deeper than all of the artificial husks. The you that comes out and emerges at real moments of life, maybe once during your lifetime. Don't let your husk rob you away from your inner beauty, innocence. It's not fear. It's not fear to yourself. It's not fear to truth. It's simply it cannot fear and it can't work. It can't work ultimately. This was the general theme. Now specifically, let's review briefly before we begin the structure of these 8 chapters, which are difficult chapters, they're complicated chapters, as you recall. So let's review very briefly the structure. In chapters 18 and 19, the Alter Rebbe discussed the fact that every single Jew experiences at the core of his being a powerful love towards Hashem, which he defined as an Ahava Mesuteris, a passion, a love towards spirituality, and a profound awareness of and bond with Hashem. It may be concealed, it may lay dormant, latent, but it can never be obliterated or eradicated. The Jew can always rely and trust that bond. It will never fail him. It's integral to his very chemistry. You can trust it. It's there. You might not feel it, but it's there. That's who you are. If never else, it comes out in the majority of cases when the Jew is challenged in his very faith in Hashem. When there's an attempt made to tear him away from his people, from his brothers and sisters, when he's being coerced to betray his people, his Jewishness, his God. Then the quintessential love and commitment of the Jew and bond of the Jew with Hashem will come to the fore. And he'll be ready even to sacrifice his life, not to abandon his God, not to abandon his people. And the story of the Jewish people during the last 3,300 years of history is sadly replete with this abnormal phenomenon. Jews who had a scarce Jewish education, as the Alter Rebbe explains. Jews whose level of observance was extremely poor. Jews who seemed to be religious outcasts. Jews who we might have called today secular, and so on and so forth, uninterested, lightheaded, sinners. Nevertheless, at a certain moment, when they were compelled to shed the last layer of their Jewish identity, when they were demanded to extinguish the last spark of their Jewish flame, they refused to do it under all costs, even the cost of torture and death, heaven forbid. How does one explain this amazing historical fact, which doesn't have its parallel, its comparison in any other culture, civilization, or people? The martyrs among the Jewish people included apostates, heretics, sinners. How do you explain this abnormal phenomenon? For the Alter Rebbe, this serves as the deepest testimony to the truth that at the core of his identity, the Jew is one with Hashem. That the ultimate definition of the self of the Jew is Hashem. And when that oneness emerges, the truth of God becomes the Jew's instinctive choice. When the Jew dies for his faith, he's not surrendering himself for the sake of the God of Avraham Avinu. He's just being who he is, one with Hashem. In chapters 20 and 21, the Alter Rebbe begins to address the fact, in the beginning of 20, he begins to discuss the fact that every mitzvah every positive mitzvah is essentially a continuum of the mitzvah of Hashem's unity, of believing in Hashem's unity. And every transgression, every aver is a continuum of avodah zarah, of idolatry. And to explain this, he discusses first the meaning, the true meaning of Achdus Hashem, the unity of Hashem. Which means not only that the world doesn't have a second creator outside of Hashem, but much more than that. That the world has no reality outside of Hashem. The world has no reality independent of the divine identity, the divine utterance, the divine word that grants it life and design at every moment. The world has no ego. It has no I outside of the divine I. There was a Yid who lived in our generation. His name was Reb Meir Nosson Hofstein. And he once related that he lived in Vienna before the war, and he once met there a Jew who was a great-great-grandson of the holy Yuzhny, Reb Yisrael of Ruzhin, the great Hasidic master of Ruzhin. And when this grandchild of the Ruzhny heard that the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe was near Vienna, he was in a place called Furgsdorf because of his health, he decided that he wants to go visit him, and Reb Meir Nosson Hofstein, who lived in Vienna at the time, accompanied him to the Rebbe. And when the man came into the Rebbe, he told the Rebbe that he heard a story from his father, who heard it from his grandfather, who heard it all the way back to the generations, a story that happened with their own great-great-great-grandfather who was the Maggid of Mizrich, because the Ruzhner was a descendant of the Maggid of Mizrich. That's also connected to the Alter Rebbe, and that's why he's sharing this story with the Rebbe, with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It was once the night of Rosh Hashanah. We spoke about Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. Here's another one. It was the night of Rosh Hashanah, and the Maggid, the Mizrich Maggid, finished davening the first night, and all of his students finished davening, and they went to sit down at the meal. But the Alter Rebbe was still davening. As I mentioned before, all the Rebbes of Chabad were davening the first night of Rosh Hashanah for a very, very long time. And the Maggid did not start the meal. He didn't make Kiddush. He was waiting for the Alter Rebbe to finish. Now the Alter Rebbe, Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, was the youngest student of the Maggid. So the other students got upset with him, that the Rebbe has to wait for him. They didn't say anything, but in their minds they felt a grudge, a negative energy towards the Alter Rebbe. And the Maggid felt what they were thinking. And suddenly he said, Zalman you. That's how he would call the Alter Rebbe, Zalman you. He said, Zalman you. When he says the words in the davening of Rosh Hashanah, he asks Hashem, V'yeda kol pol ki ata pa'altai. And every existence should know and be aware that you, Hashem, has brought it into existence. When Zalman Yu says those words, he doesn't move from the shtender on which he's davening till the shtender actually feels ki ata pa'altai. Till the shtender, the pulpit, the piece of wood on which he's standing and davening, feels and experiences that it has no reality outside of the divine identity. And that's what's taking him so long. parenthetically, when this Jew finished telling the story to the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rebbe said that there always existed a special connection between the Hasidic dynasty of Ruzhin and the Hasidic dynasty of Chabad. Because when the holy Ruzhin had passed away, there were no telegrams. And suddenly, one day, in the middle of the day, the Hasidim saw that the Tzemach Tzedek sat Shiva for a half an hour, which is basically the halacha when the Talmud Chacham of the generation passes away, when the great Torah scholar of the generation passes away. One sits Shiva for half an hour, and he sat Shiva for half an hour. And then they found out that particularly at that moment, the Ruzhin had passed away. In any case, this was the beginning of the theme of chapter 20, that the world has no identity outside of the divine word that gives it being. In the continuation of 20, and in chapter 21, the Alter Rebbe elucidates the next point. And the next point is much deeper than the first point. That in the presence of the inner intimate self of Hashem, the world not only doesn't have an ego, but it doesn't have an identity of its own. Because as the Alter Rebbe said, a word, when it's still included in the emotion, producing the word, is submerged and nullified within the emotion, possessing no name or distinct identity outside of the emotion. For example, the words, I love you, when they are still within the emotion of love, have no distinct identity outside of the emotion. But in the case of human beings, the words ultimately leave the emotions. They leave his mouth, and that's how they're communicated to another human being. And there they assume, so to speak, existence, identity, status, value. But by Hashem, the words, even after they created a world, never left his intimate self. So in Hashem's presence, the entire universe is as though non-existent, and the only reality is Hashem. However, Hashem concealed and obscured his inner presence, his intimate self, and this granted all of the worlds a sense of self-consciousness, a sense of identity. Because by concealing his inner presence, he allows the worlds to perceive the divine words which are creating them as though they have left the inner intimate self of the speaker. It allows them to perceive the divine words as an existence. From Hashem's perspective, the concealment doesn't conceal anything. So the world from day one never assumed an identity, never assumed the title existence, because the word in the presence of the emotion is as though it's non-existent. But from our perspective, he concealed his intimate self, and this concealment is valid for our point of view. It does conceal his intimate presence from our point of view, and thus we assume an identity and a self-consciousness. In chapter 22, the Alter Rebbe describes the various stages that exist in these concealments. Stage after stage, rung after rung, thus producing various perceptions as to the nature and the character of life in the world. The stronger the concealment, the deeper the veils, the more powerful is the sense of separateness and disconnection from Hashem that characterizes this human being with this world. The greater the concealment, the greater the ego. The greater, the more dense the veil, the deeper the egotistical perception of the universe. Till the extent that the concealment is so intense and the veil is so dense that it can produce and create identities which are capable of defining themselves as deities in their own right. Even though their entire energy is coming from Hashem at that moment, and in His presence they are though non-existent, but because of the deep concealment they experience themselves as deities. So the natural state of reality is selflessness, self-nullification. When all is exposed, it's obvious that there is He and there's nothing else besides He. But when the truth is covered, the ego emerges. And to the extent, if the truth is covered more, the ego is more powerful. If the truth is covered less, the ego is diminished. If there's no covering, there's no ego at all. You're totally nullified. Drown in Hashem's all-pervading reality. That's the only reality. And this is the reason He said at the end of 22, for our sages equating arrogance to idolatry. It's not just a coincidental comparison, because the inflated sense of self, which is what arrogance is all about, is in essence a demonstration against the unity of Hashem.